So I'm going to be telling you about a memory that occurs in a suspension of non-Brownian particles. And so just to get you oriented, what you're looking at here is a two-dimensional slice of a 3D suspension. And these are 100 micron diameter plastic spheres. And so they're about the diameter of your hair, so they're fairly small. But they're not so small as to be thermal. Okay, so this is an athermal system. They're non-Brownian. And so all the driving is coming just from the boundaries if I apply shear. Okay, so that's what I'm going to be talking about. And just to give a kind of a list of where this stuff appeared in the literature, so the original simulation work appeared here, and then we looked a little bit further at some of the properties in the simulations here. And then the experiments I'm going to be telling you about came out a little bit later. And so all of this work was done in collaboration with Sid Nagel and Nathan Keim when Nathan and I were students at Chicago, and we've now moved to other places. And what I'm not going to be telling you about today, but another very interesting aspect of these systems is that you can get very glassy behavior in these granular suspensions. And so we were able to observe and actually explain why you get stretch exponential relaxation in a simple one-dimensional version of this sheared suspension, just to give a statement about that, but I won't be talking about it. And then in just recently this year, I've been working on other types of aspects of this system, looking at how hyperuniformity emerges due to shear, and so that's work done with collaborators at Syracuse. Again, I won't be talking about that today, so this is just the commercial. The other hat that I wear is I'm studying the geometry and elasticity of very thin elastic sheets, and again, I'm not going to be talking about that, but I think one reason it's relevant is that later in this workshop, I believe you're going to be hearing from Lahini about how you can actually store a memory in an elastic sheet, which is crumpled and uncrumpled. And so if there are things that come out of this workshop where I could start looking for memories in these little wrapped droplets, that would also be very interesting for me. Okay, so that's sort of just a broad introduction to myself. And now for the main event. So broadly speaking, as we've heard about already in this workshop, a memory is a protocol for encoding and storing and retrieving some pieces of information. Okay, and so these are some of the situations where we typically think about memories and systems. But for those of you who weren't here last Friday, I'll just briefly show a slide about what Sid told us, which is that you have memory effects spanning a very wide range of physical systems. So you can think of a spin echo as a memory. Yesterday we heard a very nice talk by Enzo on aging and rejuvenation in glasses, which is a completely distinct type of memory behavior. And I believe later on we'll be hearing from Karen about return point memory in magnetic materials, where you can nest hysteresis loops inside each other like little Russian nesting dolls, and you can recover all of the turning around points at a later time. Okay, and so what I'm telling you about today is what we think is a distinct class of memory called multiple transient memories, and we'll go from there. So to get you kind of started thinking about memories in a disordered sort of granular type material, I want you to do a little bit of a thought experiment with me. So we're going to take a dry sand and place it in between the two concentric cylinders, and then we can apply shear to the sand by rotating the central cylinder. And so I'm showing you the shear rate, and I want you to try to guess, if you can, what the torque is going to look like on the central rod. So here I'm rotating clockwise at constant shear rate, stopping, rotating clockwise again at constant shear rate, stopping, and then rotating counterclockwise at constant shear rate. Okay, so I'll show you the first one. So the first torque that you would measure in that first cycle is this brief transient before you reach a steady state constant, approximately constant value of the torque on the cylinder. So does anybody want to guess what happens in the next cycle?
But you're saying that it actually, right as you turn off the shear rate, torque goes to zero.
That's right.
Is that obvious that it's going to zero?
Okay, so I'm being a little bit, so I'm showing you sand, but these are measurements in actually a suspension. So that's a little bit different because in sand you have a constant, you have a force networks. In the suspension, you probably don't have percolating contact networks. So forgive me that detail.
So do I mean, we do that experiment all the time. And unless you unload it, it will just stay put. If you allow it to relax, if you unload it, then of course it changes. But if you freeze it, it will stay pretty close to where
it will be right where you left off. Yep.
We go back to the same.
So that's what you get. So you pick up right where you left off. If there's no inertia in the system, then there's no way for the system to notice that you've stopped and restarted because it's completely overdamped anyway. Okay, so now the trickier one, what happens when you reverse the direction? Exactly. Okay, so now we get the transient in the opposite direction. And I think this is maybe a little bit reminiscent of what Michael showed us in another, it was named another thing in
the Bauschinger effect.
And so one nice thing about this is actually you have it, okay, so first of all,
this is a measurement, right? So is it leading zero in between?
It's a measurement on the suspension, so there's not constant, there's not necessarily a percolating, there aren't necessarily force chains in the system.
It's a non-Brownian
suspension.
It doesn't relax the suspension.
That's right. So
he said we should think of it as entirely.
So I'm not sure if I have a good answer for that. Maybe that's a little bit strange. But anyway, so the thing I want to show is that, as Enzo beautifully told us yesterday, you can use this thing to write down whether you're going out or not going out to dinner, because you can remember whether you turned it right last or left last, so you can put a 1 or a 0 in this system. And yeah.
Is it obvious why the transient goes that way? I mean, my crazy guess was that the transient would go the other.
That you would overshoot and then
overshoot and then come back down. Right? So, is there a simple way to see why?
It's not obvious to me. I don't know if anyone else has more experience with these. I was surprised too that it was actually going up and not down.
In the analogous MD simulations, we'll see this kind of behavior if the system is more disordered than the shear state, and the other one if it's less disordered than the shear state, and there's softening. But I don't know if that's applicable exactly here.
You're talking about the third signal.
The first.
I think he's asking why not, why doesn't it overshoot and decay rather than it's actually climbing?
So it will do both. So this is a standard function. And if you have under consolidated, it will do it, it will act like you do. Mm-hmm. But if you've over consolidated, it will overshoot and relax back down. So this is, and if you're talking about dry ground resistance, so it's that you're fine as long as you're not over consolidated. That dense. Is that if you're dense, it will do what you not do what you do. If it's low density, you can sort of chain it up. It will do exactly what you drew up to maybe when your draw is dropping. Because if you don't actually unload it, it won't drop. If you freeze frame that rotating cylinder, it will just stay there. And you have to actually back off. Because what you've done is you've established a static force network. And that will stay there until you reverse it.
Sure.
And that's what you're doing at the second point. You're reversing it. And since these things are quasi-static, I think that's sort of where you're going. Then as long as you fix it, it'll happily stay there until the cows come home, more or less. And then when you reverse the shear, it will go down quite sharply. These are not major differences, but there are sort of minor corrections to the picture and footnotes, if you like, about what the ground must have happened and like to get that initial rise.
So maybe just to kind of make a summary statement. Again, these are measurements actually in a fluid suspension. And so probably what you're seeing at the very beginning is just the fluid response. And because it's relatively dilute, it takes a while before the particles start to push back on you. So this would be a dilute case.
Yeah, so I think this is the thing maybe that I would change is I would say it's not sand. And mm-hmm. What you're showing right off the bat that this is not like sand.
Sure.
In some ways. And you don't get sort of permanent force in that part because you're too loud. And so then your picture becomes valid and it's not a pile of sand.
Mm-hmm. So these are all good things to note, but the broad point that you can remember the direction, I think that's robust across multiple packing fractions, dry, wet. So the experiments are Godalmerian and Acrobosin suspensions, and then later some experiments were done in dry grains.
So suppose you're like a really long time. So in other words, it looks like you're unloading the network partially during the time, but not totally. So the question is, how long? I assume the particles just don't diffuse fast enough to really rearrange that much.
That's right. They're large, very much non-Brownian. Yeah. Yeah. Okay. So the kind of striking thing about this is that you get this response in a suspension, this kind of general memory of a direction, but you also get this response in a system of charge density waves. And so the analogous experiment there is that you drive a current into your charge density wave conductor, and the first time you drive a current in the positive direction, you get a voltage response that has a transient. But the second time you drive the current across the conductor, you get a very fast response, and you immediately return to that steady state voltage that you measured. But then if you reverse the sign of the current, again, you get this transient. And so you get qualitatively the same behavior where you can remember this. So this was called a pulse sign memory. And so you remember what the sign is of the last current pulse that you fed into the system. Okay. So as Sid said on Friday, but not all of us were here, so I'm going to go through it again. You actually have a richer set of memory behaviors in these charge density wave conductors. So I showed you the pulse sign memory on the last slide, but it's actually more than that. You can remember the duration of a pulse. And so this is the cartoon for how that works. If you send a series of fixed width pulses into your system, fixed duration, then if you measure the voltage as a response, at first you see some oscillations at the beginning, but pretty much a constant steady state and a drop at the end. But after many, many inputs of the same width current pulse, eventually you start to pick up little oscillations at the end of the voltage response. And those oscillations pick up and they're actually phase locked with the end of the pulse. So that the system is actually sort of anticipating when you're about to turn the current off. And of course it can't know when you're going to turn it off, but it's learned when you have been turning it off in the last several cycles. Okay. And the other thing is that this takes multiple cycles to train, and so this is a steady state response after many of these input pulses.
Is that a sliding charge density wave?
I believe so, although I'm not.
So, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think so.
Whether it's a sliding charge density wave. So the thing that's actually even more remarkable is that it's not just the memory of one duration that you can store. You can store multiple durations. So if I feed in a long pulse and then a short pulse and a long pulse and a short pulse, you actually build up these features where these oscillations become appear and become phase locked at both of those times, tau 1 and tau 2, as I've shown here. And you can do, so in the experiments, they showed four different pulse durations that were all simultaneously learned by the system. Okay. And so what was found in simulations of the system was that at long times, you would actually, so at intermediate times, you would learn all four of these pulse durations. But at very long times, you would forget all but the shortest duration and the longest duration. So you only remember the most extreme things that you fed into the system, the shortest and the longest.
What do you mean by short and long times? Like you keep training it though?
So I mean, I'm going to feed in, say, tau 1, tau 2, tau 3, and tau 4, and I'm going to keep cycling these through. And it's only going to remember, say, tau 1 if that's the smallest of the taus, and tau 4 if that's the largest of the taus. So this is the shortest duration and the longest duration are the ones that it eventually remembers.
But eventually, during that eventually time, you're constantly presenting these four.
That's right.
It's not like you're just waiting.
That's right. You're constantly feeding them in, and after many, many cycles, you keep feeding in tau 1, tau 2, tau 3, tau 4, but it just can't remember 2 and 3. It's only able to retain.
And the pulse half times can be disordered? It doesn't matter.
I'm not sure as much what was probed there.
The experiments didn't change that, but certainly in the model, if you look in the model that you developed, nothing is happening in that. So presumably in the real experiment, that if you wait too long, everything starts from scratch again. Everything disorders, but. So you just don't want it to be very long.
And my question was, is this a periodic signal in some sense? It's not periodic.
It's not periodic. And they don't have to be presented 1, 2, 3, 4, 1, 2, 3, 4. It can be 1, 3, 2, 4, 1, 1, 2, 2, 3, 1, 4.
So
it doesn't, the order of presentation doesn't matter. As long as they're all roughly kept going.
So there was some understanding of this from the simulations, and the nice thing from the simulations was that you could turn on and off noise. So what they learned was that if you actually put noise into the system, you would actually remember all of these different pulse widths. So that somehow noise was keeping you in a state where you didn't have this forgetting. In the experiments, they couldn't turn on and off the noise, and so the interpretation was that there was always enough noise present that you would sustain all of the memories. Okay?
So Duncan, will you talk about why the noise does that? Or is that...
I will talk about that for the suspensions, and I think we have a good picture of that.
Okay.
Yeah. Okay, so just to kind of recap what's kind of weird about this. So what you might naturally sort of intuitively expect about a memory is that the more times you write something, you keep trying to encode the same thing, the stronger that memory should become. And you might also have the sense that having random noise in your system is going to maybe interfere with the writing. And so, you know, how could noise actually be a good thing? Usually it's something that destroys or gets in the way of the signal. But in this system of traveling charge density waves, you have a system that can learn multiple inputs, but it actually forgets them even as they're continually fed in. So that's the first strange thing. And that also noise is somehow a beneficial agent in this system, that it's helping you retain all of this information. Okay, so that's the really strange, couple of really strange aspects. And one question you might have is this just unique to charge density waves? Is this some sort of isolated one-off effect? Or is there a more general mechanism that you could find in other physical systems? And so I'm going to tell you that yes, we've found it in sheared non-Brownian suspensions. And the other thing that you might be wondering is, okay, what's leading to this strange behavior? And so the other part of my talk is to try to explain why these are actually not all that strange once you see the underlying mechanisms. Okay, so that's sort of the program of this talk. And the clue that led us to all of this is that the memory in these systems is programmed into a steady state. And so I'm going to show this video again for those of you who weren't here last Friday. So this is a fluid, very viscous fluid, which is held in this concentric cylinder geometry. And this little blob of red dye is being mixed around as the central cylinder is rotated. And then now G.I. Taylor here is taking his finger and reversing the direction of the rotation. And there's no movie magic here. So eventually this blob comes back to where it started. This is fun every time I see it. I never get tired of this. So this is the hydrodynamic reversibility of Stokes flows. You have time invariant symmetry for Stokes flows. And so this is just a simple laminar flow. And so you can shear it forward. And when you shear it back, you're precisely reversing all of the trajectories of each fluid parcel. OK, so returning back to granular or suspensions, one question you might want to ask is, what happens to this little blob of dye if it's in a fluid that has a bunch of particles inside of it as well? So we're going to add a bunch of non-Brownian particles into this fluid and perform the same protocol, where we shear forward and shear backward, and we ask whether it's a reversible process. And so this was work done by Dave Pine, Jerry Golub, Paul Chaikin, and others several years ago. And what they learned was that these particles destroy this reversibility property for the first few cycles. But if you're shearing back and forth, you know, not five or six rotations, but just if you're shearing forth just a small amount, eventually you can settle into a reversible state where all of the particles are just retracing their trajectories forwards and backwards and forwards and backwards. Okay, and so what that means in this diagram is, so here's the strain as a function of time, and so I'm going forwards, backwards, forwards, backwards. And so if I take a stroboscopic images of the system, if I take a picture each time I get back to zero strain, if I compare these two images early on, these images will look different. If I compare these images later on, these images will look exactly the same. So the particles are just retracing their paths and ending up at the same spot at this point. Yeah?
Can you comment on how fast you need to move this? Like, if you move it really fast, would it happen?
So we're still staying in the low Reynolds number limit, at least in the limit where a pure fluid would be reversible. And so that's certainly important for this. If you drive it fast enough where there's inertia, of course, you'll destroy this property. But as long as you're in the low Reynolds number limit, it doesn't matter how fast you go, so that if I did this one twice as fast as the next one, that's not
try to link it to its other properties, like the radius, things like that. How fast do you need to do this to break it?
I'm not sure what you're asking.
What I mean is that you increase the speed, but does that speed depend on other properties of the system? Like the radius of this cylinder.
So the thing that you want to keep small is the Reynolds number, and so the Reynolds number is the product of the gap width. And so the smaller you get, the more Stokesian you're going to be. And of course the velocity, the slower you go, the more Stokesian you're going to be. And the fluid viscosity, which in this case the fluid viscosity is very large, so that sets that makes it a bit easier to get into this regime. Yeah, of course, all of these things are important, but all of the stuff I'll show you is in the low Reynolds number, so Reynolds number of 0.005 order of magnitude. Okay, so I'm going to introduce to you a little toy model, and this is a toy model that was used to understand this transient irreversibility of the suspension experiment. But we're also going to use this model to explain the memory behaviors. And so I just want to sort of make sure to go through this carefully, because we're going to be using this several times to make sense of these strange memories later on. And so the algorithm is pretty simple. You lay particles down in a two-dimensional box at some specific area fraction phi. And then we're applying just an extremely simple shear algorithm. All we're doing is we're just taking the centers of the particles and translating them affinely, okay, where the amount that we translate is just proportional to how far you are from the bottom wall. So it's just a simple shear transformation. And the particles can pass through each other, completely allowed. Okay, so there's not really any interactions to worry about during the shear. But any particles that overlap at any point in the cycle, we're going to give them a small random kick after we bring it back to the zero amplitude position. Okay, and so that's how we're going to kind of mimic particle interactions that are mediated by contacts. Okay. And then we're just going to keep looping this over and over and over again and see how the system evolves. So are there any questions about the algorithm? All clear?
So that means they don't pass each other. I mean, there is an interaction.
That's right. There is an interaction, but I'm not doing it in a complicated way where I have to worry about the flow field. I'm just doing it by proximity. That's right. Okay, so this is now going to be a stroboscopic video where we just follow this system forward in time. So I'm showing you a snapshot. Every time I get back to zero shear, I take another snapshot. And so the red particles are encountering somebody during the shear cycle, and they're getting a kick. And so effectively, they're diffusing because of these random kicks. But as soon as a region stops encountering any other particles nearby, it's just going to remain the same. Okay, so this is the end state, and it'll keep looking like this indefinitely. Okay, because at this point, during a shear cycle, no particles encounter any other particles during the cycle, and so everything is reversible. Is that clear? So in a sense, this is nice because it's showing the same qualitative behavior as the experiments. It's showing a transient irreversibility, but in the steady state, it finds its own reversible steady state all by itself.
Is that the only steady state?
There's an infinitely many different steady states, and they're just being randomly sampled.
Same class, and it's like they're all of this type. I mean, they're all going to reach some asymptotic state that's then reversible.
So this is for small shears. If I apply a shear that's too large, I may never find a reversible steady state, but there's still going to be some transient and some irreversible steady state that I reach. Sorry.
So you should rather prove that analytically, right? The long time.
Prove analytically that there's a threshold for.
No, this is some fixed point of your evolution.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. So you write down the rules you have and look for the asymptotics in time and some fixed point of this type. That's what you're saying, it reaches this steady state.
I'm not quite sure what you mean about predicting something. I mean, so you can check whether a state is reversible just by taking the state, applying a shear transformation, and just checking to see if anything overlaps anything else. So there's a very simple way of just checking whether a particular configuration is reversible. But you want to do something else. Yeah, that's right. That's right.
I'm just saying take your equations of motion. Write down the rules on the previous and then look for a fixed point in time that's stationary like this.
Mm-hmm.
Shouldn't want to be able to do that analytically.
But in some sense, this seems more like a cramped state because the particles are sort of, they're diffusing as long as they're within a certain radius of each other, or like maybe you have some anisotropic sort of neighborhood, but then as soon as they're outside that neighborhood, then they don't feel each other at all.
Yeah.
So it seems more like it's like something where you, as soon as the particles get outside these shapes where they feel each other, then they don't do anything. So it seems.
So it's a jump state for some larger particles than what we are.
Yeah, effectively they're like larger, like ellipsoids or something, like
propeller shaped.
So, I mean, that's at least my.
That's right. So these are called absorbing states because once you get to one of them, you stay in that state forever.
And I don't quite understand how you would do that if the kicks are random. then I'm not quite sure how you find the fixed point analytically on that. But it was certainly.
You have to see the noise. Light noise. I don't know. Look at the time evolution. All it from those rules is noise. And look for, like, it can be jammed, it can be, I mean, it's complicated state.
I mean, if you figure out what these shapes are, presumably you could, I don't know.
So they're simple shapes.
Yeah, maybe you can estimate if you can cover the space.
So the picture on the web page for this whole program is that from Polar Shape. That's exactly what that is.
Okay.
So the shape is really easy to see why it is. So if you have a particle somewhere, say at the origin, then you want to know where could another particle center be and not overlap with this one. And so just if there's no shear at all, there's an excluded area, okay, which is just given by whether you're overlapping with this disk. The shear just tells you, okay, I should just shear this excluded area. And so I'm going to take this circle and shear, just apply a shear transformation to the circle itself. Okay. And of course, there's a continuous number of circles between this one at zero shear and the one at gamma naught. And so all of those circles are going to pile up in this region. Okay, and so this is now the entire excluded region that you would see at the zero shear configuration. So
this is from half a center.
So I'm only shearing to the right and back to the center. Yeah.
So I guess what that was suggesting is, so there's an entire branch of mathematics that they study, or applied mathematics that they study, so-called limiting distributions, which are universal in some way, like normal distribution, regular random statistics. So people study all kinds of models, domino, complex shapes, packing, and so on. So often, the same pattern emerges in many different systems, independently of the precise shapes and rules and so on. Sometimes not, sometimes yes. When they occur many times, that's what the mathematicians are interested in, really important for physics. So it'll be interesting to see the same kind of shapes appear in other systems. But you don't even need a precise shape, right? You just have this reversible behavior, essentially.
Yeah, so
I mean, the shape is in some way a criteria for checking if you're reversible. So you lay this shape down in every particle, and as long as there aren't any other particle centers in those shapes, you know that you're all set.
Right, but there could be many possible shapes. That's what I was asking before. Principle.
Not sure.
You mean if you do a different kind of perturbation to your system?
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, so yeah, you could swell everything, and then they'd just be spheres.
Yeah.
I mean, so that would be a different thing. But for this, you only have that one propeller.
Well, so I mean, one thing that Don Frankel and his colleagues have done is to sort of, you know, they did it a full cycle, so that the shape looks a little different. But
it looks like a butterfly if you go
looks
right.
Like a butterfly, and then you can say I can think of the system as being made up of particles with these butterfly-shaped interactions, exclusion interactions, and then you can ask what's the equilibrium distribution. But it turns out there's a twist in that story, because the equilibrium distribution for a system with this butterfly potential is not what you find as a result of applying this protocol, because you can sort of see that would be the case, because if you're doing this kind of athermal sort of shearing back and forth, whenever you have a configuration that's sort of at the edge of the allowed phase space, right, it sort of preferentially stays there. Right? Because what's the simplest way to look is, to think about it is if I take two particles, which come into contact with each other when I shear. When I shear back, they're going to stay together. I mean, with more or less, right? I mean, they're going to be closer than they were before. And that sort of accumulation of contacts is something that keeps happening. So you're sort of, this is, I think, what you mentioned was also an idea that had been explored in the charge density range. So the distribution is around equilibrium distribution.
I never said it had to be.
No, I'm just saying.
Yeah, I understand.
So this right. much has been done in terms of analyzing what kind of distributions you reach.
Yeah.
But whether you can actually get that distribution that you do see, I don't think anybody is.
I mean, they occur in rule-based models, not equilibrium stationary often. Rule-based models.
Yeah.
But you're saying they didn't compute the distribution you get by this shearing method?
No, they did both and compared and showed that they're not the same.
One is always on the boundary.
So again, I can just do an equilibrium sampling with this funny potential and compare with what I get when I do the
shearing.
And they showed that they're not the same.
So,
yes. On a different issue, can you look at that picture and tell what was the shear direction? I mean, I imagine trying to make like a bond orientation order parameter or something like that. That if the, you know, a lot of chains are running this way, and that's an indication that those shapes must have been this way, and that shows you which way the shear could have been.
So I'm going to show you the pair correlation function later, and it's extremely clear in that measure, both what the direction was, but also what the amplitude was. They're just imprinted into that. So I think some of this discussion is actually quite relevant to the point I'm going to make next, which is that these reversible states are unique in some sense, or they have a specific property, which is that the particles are sort of piled up right on the edge of what their permissible positions would be. So what I mean by that is that if I shear this system up to a strain amplitude gamma naught, I know that I'm reversible because, as I've said, I've come to a reversible state under that driving. And I also know that I'm reversible for smaller amplitudes than that because the smaller shear is contained within the shear to gamma naught. But if I just push slightly further to gamma naught plus just epsilon more, there's going to be collisions where a particle just barely encounters a neighbor that it would have missed before. And so there's in general going to be a lot of collisions just for epsilon further driving the system. Is that clear? So in that sense, we can think of this distribution of particles, this set of positions, as a memory of the amplitude gamma zero. Because I can read it out exactly in that way. So what I mean by that is I train the system by straining back and forth and back and forth up to some gamma naught that I choose, and then I can read out, and I do this until I reach a reversible steady state, and I can read this value out just by applying a small shear and a larger one and a larger one and a larger one, and eventually when I exceed the amplitude gamma naught, I'm going to start seeing collisions. Okay, and so I'll show you in the next slide what we that measures that we actually did in the simulation, and the quantity of interest I'm going to call f move. So f move is the fraction of particles. So it's a number between 0 and 1. It's the fraction of particles that collide if I give some trial shear up to gamma. Okay, so it's a function of the strain amplitude gamma. And so here's what the picture looks like. So at zero cycles, this is just, I've rained down particles at random in my box. And so of course there's going to be lots of collisions no matter what strain amplitude you apply. But then after applying, say, 30,000 cycles, I'm in this reversible steady state. And this reversible steady state, as advertised, there's no collisions up to gamma naught. There's no collisions for strains smaller than gamma naught, but the number of collisions picks up very rapidly for infinitesimally larger shears. That's the signal or the signature, if you like, of a memory in this system of a single number. Are there any questions about that? And just to emphasize that gamma naught can be any number that I like. Okay, so it's that's in the sense that I can store actually a value. So this is better than storing one or zero. I can store an actual sort of continuous value to have any value that I like. Okay, so that's the toy model for a single memory. Okay, so I claim that I'm going to show you much, much more, and I will. I need to show you that it forgets things and that noise can help and all of that wonderful stuff. But before I do that, I just want to show you this very simple single memory done in an experiment, and then we'll get back to these other properties, okay, at the end. So here's the experimental system. It looks a lot like the demo that Sid showed us all on Friday, and a lot like the video I just played, except now I have particles that are floating inside of the suspension. Okay, and so this pink stuff is the suspension, which is, so I'll tell you all about it in a second, all of this great stuff. So the fluid is a mixture of these three ingredients that gives a very viscous Newtonian mixture. The particles are PMMA spheres, about 100 microns in diameter, and their density match to better than 1 part in 10 to the 4, so that I don't have to worry about particles sinking or floating on the time scale of the experiments. Okay, so it's a neutrally buoyant suspension. It's non-Brownian suspension. I achieve this by having large enough particles and a high enough viscosity, and so you can calculate something called the Pouclet number. The Pouclet number compares diffusion to the advection due to shear, and the fact that this is 10 to the 9th says that the shear is driving the particles 10 to the 9 times more than Brownian motion is driving the particles. So really, really athermal system. Getting back to a question earlier, it's in the low Reynolds number limit so that I don't have to worry about inertia, and I get in that limit by having a high viscosity, relatively low shear rate, and relatively small gap, and so all three of those ingredients give you the Reynolds number. And boundary conditions, very important. The top boundary condition is open to air. The bottom boundary is floating on a high density, but very low viscosity oil. And so the top and bottom surfaces are essentially stress-free. So that's makes me worry less and less about boundary effects, which is convenient. And then finally, to image this thing, which I'll show you in a couple of slides, the particles and the fluid have a refractive index which is matched so that I can shine a sheet of laser light into the suspension and I can visualize a two-dimensional slice of the particles. Okay, and then I'm doing particle tracking using a very common and popular method in the community. Okay, so this is what it all looks like in the lab. So you have the shear cell, which is surrounded by this big tank of fluid just to give it nice thermal stability and also to make it easy to shine a sheet of laser light into this curved shear cell. You have a camera for imaging and a set of laser optics. But when I was looking back at this slide from my grad school days, the thing that's actually the most important is this laser cut acrylic smiley face that I just remembered. I had bolted into the table so that I had a friend through his eyes.
If you want a friend in graduate school,
gotta make your own.
Then you gotta bolt into the table.
Okay, so here's the picture of the suspension and room lighting. This is a picture with a sheet of laser light going into the sample. This is a zoom in. So again, this is a huge system. So that's one nice thing about the experiments, in addition to all the other features, is that you have a ton of averaging going on in this system. And there's no increase in computational time for all that averaging. And then finally, there's a long pass filter that removes all these little bright reflected spots off in impurities. Okay, so that's the system. Okay, so I'm going to do exactly what I did in the simulation. I'm going to shear the suspension for 100 cycles at a strain amplitude of gamma equals 1.6, which just means that the inner wall is moving 1.6 times the width of the gap. And eventually, if I've reached a reversible state, well, that's what I'm going to try to check now, is to see if I've reached a reversible state. And so I'm going to do this shear protocol where I apply successively larger and larger shears to the sample. And I'm going to compare consecutive pictures, compare this picture to this one and this one to this one, to see how reversible I am under that applied shear. And this is what you get. Okay, so this was extremely exciting. This is the most exciting piece of blank monotone gray that maybe you'll ever see. This means that the picture before and after the shear were the exact same picture, basically, so that when I subtract them from each other, I get this smooth monotone result. Okay, and that's the case for shears that are smaller than 1.6. And when I apply shears larger than what I had been training the system at, then I start to get displacements. And so a displacement can be seen because it's going to be slightly black where the particle has left and white where the particle has moved over to. So you get these little crescents that show you this irreversibility.
Do you see the same at other gamma values?
So if I had trained at a different gamma, yeah. That's right, you can do this. So I'll show you in a couple slides that we checked that. Okay, so that's the qualitative kind of proof. Quantitatively, we can do this even nicer. So these are the actual particle displacements blown up by a factor of 25. And so I can take these displacement vectors and I can create a distribution of measured displacement vectors. And then because this is a somewhat sensitive measurement, I'm going to subtract off any type of drift. So if the camera shook to the left or the right, or if there was slow convection in the system, I want to take out any uniform displacement of particles and just leave in the non-correlated motions of particles. And so what that means is I'm going to measure the variance of my distribution of particle displacements, and that's my measure of irreversibility. So if that's small, I'm reversible. If that's large, I'm irreversible. And so this is the actual measurement. So again, this is the variance of particle displacements comparing the system before and after a shear of a given value. And so for a random system with no training, this has no features in it. But for the system that was trained 100 times at 1.6, this value is 0, 0, 0, 0, and then it picks up beyond that.
This is again the variance you calculate by looking at over different cycles of B.
The variance I get by taking a picture here and actually measuring the positions of all the particles in my frame of view, and then taking a picture here and measuring their positions, and then getting the displacement vectors. So it's like a mean squared displacement. Yeah, exactly. Okay, and so then to be even more precise or sort of to pick these memories out in an even stronger way, what I've done is I've taken the second derivative of this function. So that's going to pick up areas of large curvature or large kinks. And then I've divided by the amplitude, which especially picks up places where the signal is small, going to a place where the signal is big. And so in that measure, I get this extremely well-defined sharp peak at 1.6 compared to the system with no training, which is just basically nothing. And I just want to emphasize the scale of these bars. So this is a peak of amplitude 15,000, and this is a signal of less than 25. Okay, so it's a really, can be made very precise and very quantitative. It's not just sort of a demo, it's something that you can really make precise. Okay, and then just to get back to the earlier questions, so these are different training protocols to make sure I could read out different values. Okay. So again, so each of these was a system that started out random, and I trained it 100 times at one of these amplitudes.
What are the different heights? Oh, that's, yeah, I see what you
mean. Okay. So you can look at these things in the irreversibility of the material, but you can also look at them just in the mechanical measurement. So I've trained this thing by kind of clearing out particles within a certain range, so neighbors are just far enough away that they don't collide for this strain amplitude. But if I shear just a little bit further, now I'm going to encounter a lot of collisions, because now I'm going to start to feel particles that I had just missed for smaller strains. So if you imagine, again, doing this shear experiment where you rotate the central cylinder, you're going to actually feel the memory. It's going to be you're going to start to feel a larger torque right when you get all these collisions at the amplitude that you had trained. And so I'm going to train the system many times at some amplitude, and then I'm just going to apply a constant strain rate shear, and I'm just going to measure the torque. And so this is what the measurement looks like. So this is the stress measured on the central bob as a function of that single readout strain. And so there's this kind of funny looking shape, and that's not what I'm interested in. What I'm interested in is this little tiny kink here, which, again, this is data, and I've taken just one derivative of this data, and I've picked up this sharp little peak where this thing is kinked upwards at that point. And so you really can feel these collisions start to come in right as you get to that training amplitude. Yeah, Arvind.
And during the training, you feel the stress, right? During the training.
That's right. During the training, you feel the stress as well.
But it slowly goes down.
That's right.
By the time you complete training.
So, yeah, so my memory is a little bit foggy on this, but I think if you look at stress as a function of gamma, you start somewhere up here.
Yes.
So you start somewhere up here, and then so you have this kind of funny transient shape, which is something else that I'm not studying, but then you sort of slightly lower this curve and lower this curve, and so you're reducing the stress each time you go back and forth. But then the first time you go beyond this point, now you've got to make a jump up to where you started. And that's that increased kink. Is that?
My real question was going to be about this gamma C. How do you know when you fit gamma C in an experiment?
So gamma C, I haven't said much about this. So gamma C is the critical amplitude. If you go larger than this gamma C, you're never going to have reversible steady states.
Meaning, like, when you're doing the experiment, how do you know you haven't settled down yet?
So we just kind of calibrate that at the beginning of the experiment for a fixed packing fraction. We just look at the steady states and see what's the range of gammas that I can get to a steady state that's reversible.
So depending on the density, if you care about gamma C, you could keep doing it and the stress level would never fall like this.
So we never did the stress experiments above gamma C, so I'm not sure. Maybe you would have signatures above gamma C, maybe you wouldn't.
I thought that you would, that is, it doesn't go to zero, I mean, the way it does, but you can still remember things up there, and so you can learn it up to some bit, but not as well as you can learn down below. You're always getting kicked by something else if you're up there.
My question is gamma C experimentally defined or theoretically defined?
You can measure it in the experiment for sure. You just look at the reversibility at long times, and you see, do I ever get one of these gray pictures where I have the same thing before and after?
So your cycle to cycle configuration keeps evolving if you're above gamma C.
That's right. If you're above gamma C, then
there is no reference.
You're always effectively diffusing.
And the training time doesn't diverge slowly at gamma C or something. If you have a finite training time.
The training time does. So the transient diverges. I'm using a very large training time, but the transient does diverge. I'm sort of away from that divergence. Okay, so let's see. So now I'm going to shift gears. I'm going to come back to the simulation and walk through each of these other features and show how they come about, and then finally finish with the experiment showing again the same sets of things. So we had this picture for a single memory, and so now the question is, what happens if you feed in more than one strain amplitude into the system? Can you retain multiple memories of multiple strain amplitudes? And so it turns out, I think you'll be able to understand in a moment why this is the case. Having a partial memory is crucial for this. And so what I mean by a partial memory is, okay, I have this completely reversible steady state at very, very long times. But even for intermediate times, you can have a memory of an amplitude as you're feeding it into the system, which means that I have some irreversibility for small strains, but then the irreversibility rapidly picks up above the strain that I'm putting into the system. Okay, so everything is colliding and colliding, but it's just a change in the amount of collisions above that gamma that I'm feeding in. Does that make sense? So in other words, there might be some patches of the system that are reversible and other patches that are not. And so you have some kind of superposition of those reversible patches that might look like this and the irreversible patches that might have less of a signal. And so you get something kind of in between.
How many cycles did you do for the final state?
For this, it's 30,000. No, that's not right. It's 30,000. Yeah.
So have you looked at a fabric tensor? These are the particle model, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so have you looked at a fabric tensor?
We have.
Because that would actually be sensitive. If you did a particularly coarse grained, you ought to be able to see whether you're getting organized clusters.
Uh-huh.
And all the fabric tensor is the diagonal product of the contact vectors, or the normal vectors, unit vectors. So in other words, if you've got unit vectors that are tending to align in one particular direction, that will appear as an asymmetry in that tensor. And it will also tell you how many contacts you have. So it's it might be a useful way of really looking at a structure that you might be evolving.
And can you apply this to the system, to a system where you don't have a lot of contacts? That is, I have a lot of particles that are overlapped and they're diffusing, and a lot of them that are not overlapped, but there's a very small set that are just.
I think you could generalize it. So in other words, I could make a generalization, say I'm going to not do the usual version, which is I'm only looking at contacts, but I'll take the centers of particles and I'll look at particles that are within some distance of each other, mm-hmm. And look for a structure based on that. Mm-hmm. So they don't have to necessarily contact each other, because your real system doesn't do that. Even you never actually contact your system. So you still could cook up a way of looking at what kind of structure do you have at a given separation.
So we haven't done that. So we've looked at the paracorrelation function, and I'll show that to you. It would be nice to maybe talk more about that afterwards and see if that could be something we could.
Okay. Well, the paracorrelation is going to be anisotropic.
So you look at it in
a function direction.
As a function of x and y. So I'll show you in a few slides.
Yeah, okay.
It's g of x, y. Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay, so this is a partial memory. So there's nothing from preventing me from just now putting two different inputs into the system and seeing whether I get two partial memories. And it turns out that you do, so that's nice. So what I'm feeding in is one large strain and then I'm giving it somewhat smaller strains five times, and then a large strain, and then a small strain five times, and I keep repeating this sequence over and over again. Okay, and it's not necessary to feed in the two five times, but it just helps see the signal a little bit better. So I could have done this with just 3-2, 3-2, 3-2, 3-2, but the two would have been a little bit weaker, and you'd have to do more averaging. So this is just a matter of convenience to try to make this memory of the two easier to see. Okay, and sure enough, you get increases in the irreversibility both when you pass two and when you pass three, showing that the system stores that information in the transient state.
If you plotted the y-axis on a log scale, would you see this final state thing so flat, or would you see some wiggle?
You mean this final state here? So this really is zero in the sense that I know.
If you plotted this on a log scale, the y-axis.
Yeah, this is exactly zero. It's not measured to some precision. It just means that there is not a collision. So that's something that you can say is or isn't the case. So it's really zero out of, I don't know, there were 10 to the 4 particles. Zero out of 10 to the 4 particles collided. So that's really zero.
When you're doing your reading protocol, does it matter where it falls in your training protocol? Like if you did the 3 loading and then immediately did the reading, would you still remember the 2? Or do you have to do the 2 subsubsequent to the 3?
Yeah,
also have the memory of the 2?
That's an excellent question. So this kind of gets back to the distinction between this and return point memory. So here it doesn't matter. For something like return point memory, you do have to feed them in from large to small, and then you read out small to large. Mm-hmm. For here, I could have done the readout right after the 3, or I could have done it after this 2, or this 2, or this 2, and you would always see both of these things.
And how do you understand that physically? Because I would have thought a large here, like you're doing in training to the 3, would have pushed away all the small adjustments you have made in the 2. But then it must be somewhere.
Right. So I can tell you for the simulation how this comes about. For the experiment, the story is a little bit different. We actually have a hard time seeing the 2 after this 3, so I'll get to that in a little bit. For the simulation, it's pretty easy to understand in the sense that I give it a kick size of a specified magnitude. Mm-hmm. And here the kick size is something like, 0.05 particle diameters. So in one cycle, I'm not disrupting the configuration very much. And so you need many, many cycles to actually ruin the things. So in a, maybe I'll just jump to a later slide to answer that a bit more precisely. So in a 1D system, maybe I don't have it. So in a 1D system, if you apply the 3, now you have, say, a bunch of, I'll draw a picture. So I can do this just with swelling particles in a one-dimensional system. And so if I have a memory of 2, that just means that I start with point particles and I swell them up to diameter 2. And so a memory of 2 is a bunch of particles that are just barely touching when they're swelled to 2. And now if I swell to 3, I have a lot of collisions, okay, and so that's, but if I start to now let these particles diffuse under those collisions, I get some of them that go to the right, some that go to the left, some go to the right. On average, I'm not changing the density in the center of the thing, but at long times, I can gradually lower the density by kind of evaporating particles off the edges of the system. So these memories persist for many cycles because I lose them from the edges first and then eventually towards the center. So that sort of helps them last longer than they would otherwise. Okay. Okay, so the other point of interest is right down here. So you notice that the final state didn't really change. That is, the final state under driving only by 3 looks like this. The final state under driving by 3 and 2, it also has to look like this. Because if I'm completely reversible up to 3, that is, if I've completely learned the 3 amplitude, then there's really nothing to say about any smaller strain amplitudes. You can't store any information when you've set this function to be 0 over that entire interval. So that's the way that forgetting naturally comes about in this model, which is that the memories are kind of nested inside of each other. The reversibility up to 3 contains reversibility up to 2 inside of it. Okay. So then the last feature was adding noise, which helps you maintain multiple memories. And so in this set of simulations, what we did was to introduce small kicks over every single particle in the system over every single cycle, so that everything is constantly diffusing by a very small amount. And what that does is it prevents you from getting to this final fixed point of the system, and it keeps you in a state where you're always in this kind of extended transient. You're always learning, but you're always being pushed up towards the random state. And that kind of keeps you in the sort of, in a sense, this is a type of plasticity, if you like. You're in a state where you can constantly be learning different values. So I could stop training 2, and I could start training something over here and create a kink. And then I could stop training that and start training something over here and create a kink while this one disappears. So this is now a concrete example of plasticity in a simple algorithm, a simple physical system. So what I mean is that here I've trained in 2 and 3, but if I stop applying 2 and now say I start doing 3, 1, 3, 1, 3, 1, and now I'm going to start introducing a kink at 1, and the kink at 2 is going to slowly fade because I'm jiggling the system with this uniform noise. And so you can continually change what memories are stored over long times. Okay. So I'm just about finished. So I've promised you the paracorrelation function. So here it is for a single memory. So this picture corresponds to the complete reversibility for a single strain amplitude. And so you can see that there's no particles inside this entire propeller-shaped region, but that you have a lot of population piled up right on the boundary, and especially piled up right in this kink where the shape is concave. Okay, and so you can actually kind of understand that by considering particles diffusing in this region, and they're going to preferentially end up where you have large negative curvature in that region, just like if you were solving a heat type of problem. Okay, so.
This is at zero strain?
Viewed at zero strain, that's right. If I viewed it at the strain of 3, then the sky would become the circle, and the circle would become a propeller in the opposite direction.
If you remove those cuffs by changing the shape of the particle or something,
We were kind of worried about those cusps because they're kind of detrimental to putting multiple memories in the system, because this cusp doesn't really care very much what the angle of this propeller is. You really want your particles up here where they're sensitive to that angle. So, and we tried a few different things to try to get rid of the cusps. We tried pure shear instead of simple shear. I think that helped a little bit, but didn't seem to change the forgetting all that much.
The existence of the cusp depends on the shape of the particle.
Well, it depends on how you're manipulating the system, right? It's really coming from that shear. I mean, you could have just thought of, supposed to just swell all the particles as you did in 1D.
And that wouldn't have
cusp.
Yeah, that's right.
What about a combination? Sharing and swallowing, sharing and splitting, sharing and splitting.
Yeah. So I mean, if you shear in two different directions, that's actually nice because now your two strains don't overlap, so you don't have one memory nested inside of the other. And so I think that would be a different type of, maybe a slightly different type of memory, in the sense that you have memory of X that's somewhat independent of the memory in Y. So I'm not quite sure what that would mean, but so and now here's the pair correlation function for two memories. And this is in the transient state, where I've partially learned three, because there's still quite a few particles that are colliding inside of the propeller for three, and I've also partially trained two, and I can only do that because I have this difference in population between two and three, which you can only have if there's some fraction of the particles that are still undergoing collisions.
I misconfigured the colors.
Ah.
What are the colors?
So this is just showing you if I have a particle at the origin. This is showing you the probability distribution function of having a particle somewhere else in real space relative to that particle at the origin.
Right. The G of R, but the heat map to show you how big G of R.
But the reason it's not zero near the origin is because you're doing a time map.
The reason it's not zero near the origin is that this is a partial memory. So I'm in this state where I haven't, I'm in one of these states where I haven't completely become reversible. So I'm looking at these little changes in reversibility.
So what's the size of the particles?
In these units, they have a diameter of one. Not necessarily. You can have overlaps at zero strain. It just means that they're undergoing collisions.
They're not hot particles?
No, no. So they're allowed to overlap, but if they overlap, then they're given a random kick. So that's how the collision kinematics is put in this really simplified model. So it's not meant to be a realistic account of the positions, but it's meant to capture how particles respond to being in areas of large density or low density and where they go relative to each other.
But the size of this central region,
mm-hmm.
How does that compare to the size of the particle?
This is exactly one particle, two particle diameters across.
That's showing the hit of some kind of hard core.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Well, it's not a hard core, it's just that at the end of the day, there's no overlap anymore. It's, because it's athermal in that sense. If you finally reach a steady state, they are not overlapping, and that means they push each other apart, even though they're soft. So it's not a hard core.
Would that change if it were?
If there were hard core?
Yeah.
I don't know how you do the simulation particularly. I mean, that would be.
Then they would also get a kind of kick, right?
But it would be a different simulation.
That's true.
So to kind of give a sort of answer to that, we did change a lot of things in the simulations to make sure that we weren't sensitive to particular choices. So like I mentioned, we did different types of driving, swelling versus shear. We gave random kicks in some simulations. We gave center of mass conserving kicks in some simulations. We gave, so those could be away or towards. In other simulations, we gave only repulsive kicks, and we varied the size of the kicks over a big range. And so at least over this set of things, all of this qualitative memory behavior was robust. Of course, I don't know the results of simulations I haven't done, so.
No, it's quite convincing.
So maybe there's something about a hard core that would change something, but okay. So getting close to the end of the discussion time, so I can kind of quickly go through. So the very last thing I want to show is just the results from the experiments, but you kind of already know what they're going to look like because I've told you it's going to look like the simulations. So I can go through those plots, or we can just have a general discussion now and.
Well, you said it has a limited ability to store multiple memories, or more limited.
It's hard to see the small memories right after the application of the large shear. So, which doesn't mean it's not there. It means it could mean that we just need to do more averaging to see the signal above the noise. So one thing we do know is that the you can measure sort of a kick size in the experiments just by seeing what are the displacements from cycle to cycle, and those are actually pretty big. So we went in and we did simulations with these big kick size precisely for that reason, to see do you have a qualitatively different behavior with big kicks. And actually we found that you actually could see multiple memories even with the kick that was half a particle diameter. You just had to do a ton of averaging to get it.
But the assumption that it's a kick, that it's a random kick, is not obvious to me. I mean, because when you move the particle, I mean, if it's really just shoving the other particle out of the way, sweeping out the entire area, then it's removing the entire memory, and that's possible.
Sure, that's definitely a worry. If you completely hollow out this entire propeller region, then maybe you're sunk.
But that's why he did the different interactions, so that takes care of just that concern. That is, the kicks push each other particles away. That's just saying what you're saying.
Mm-hmm.
You're,
okay.
That's exactly that aspect of it that I was trying to test.
Okay, and that also preserves the intermediate memories after the large.
Yes,
that's right. But I mean, you hit on exactly the things that we worried about for a long time. So that's. Sure. I can quickly go through those. So this is the multiple memories in the experiment. So I've applied 2 and 1.2, and I've done this whole sequence 4 times. And now this is the readout, and you see this up kick at 2. And there's also an upkick at 1.2, which you can see if you expand this x-axis by a factor of 100. This is the exact same data as this. And right in here, there's just a very small increase in the slope, which you see on this expanded y-scale.
So this is with the PMMA spheres.
This is with the PMMA spheres.
And it's going forward.
Exactly. Yeah. And then we can apply the same signal where we look at 2 derivatives of this irreversibility, and we see peaks at the 2 trained values. And we've done experiments with 2 different sets of trained values and made sure that the peaks move along with whatever we're feeding in. Okay, so we have this first aspect. Forgetting is like the easiest thing to do in the experiments because that's what it's doing all the time. So if I feed in this sequence just 4 times, I get these 2 peaks in the irreversibility, in the derivatives of the irreversibility. If I feed the sequence in 8 times, I get a much stronger memory of 2 at the expense of depressing the one at 1.2, and then eventually you've completely erased a smaller memory after more applications. Okay, so that's the second. And then for noise, like I said, these are very non-Brownian particles, so I'm not going to get noise by diffusion. But what I can get is I can make use of some little imperfections in the experiment, like small density mismatches or maybe some very slow thermal convection that I might be having in my system. And so if I just pause for a long amount of time between each of these shears, then I can accumulate more and more sort of small random displacements due to these imperfections. And so first, I'm going to show you that if I don't have any pauses, then if I apply this sequence 8 times, I only have a memory of the larger amplitude. But if I have longer and longer and longer pauses in separate experiments, I can retain both memories over the same term. That's right. So this is one way of introducing noise, just by making use of imperfections in the experiment. You could also imagine going to a real colloidal system, not a non-Brown, not an athermal one, but a thermal one, and you would guess that you'd get the same thing there. No one's done it as far as I know, but that would be another way.
Question about that last point. So you've got 10 minus 4 g. Mm-hmm. And so then your effective g is a particle diameter per second squared. 100 microns per particle diameter. Mm-hmm. So that means there is some settling over some time. And the question is, how does the settling time compare to sort of a couple of minutes? So you're in a very viscous solution, so it's slow. But I wonder if the fact that you rather than sort of mechanical imperfection where it's, maybe you're just collapsing a little bit, and the longer you wait, the more it collapses, and so the more it can actually make contacts that have been pushed apart, but now they come back because the system has settled over.
So I'm not exactly sure what's happening during these pauses, but what I can tell you is that I looked at long times just to see what was happening to a system that I wasn't driving. So I would just take a time lapse over a night. And what you see is just very slow, what looks like convection rolls of the system. So it's not that everything is sinking, it's that some things are going up and some things are going down, which I interpreted as some small temperature gradients in the system.
But I mean, still on a period of minutes, you might really have to particle. You don't have to go very far.
That's right. You don't have to
particle contact.
If you're away by epsilon, you just have to sink epsilon to be back.
That's, I mean, just assume you have Stokes' law, and your particle is settling under 10 to the minus 4 g, and ask how long does it take to go, some fraction of a particle down to make a contact. Mm-hmm. I think it's not a hard calculation. So Stokes' law, the force is what, 6 pi. Times its constant times the radius times the speed. So it's easy to calculate the settling.
Mm-hmm. I mean, I think what you would get is that if you're just, say, a micron away from hitting, then you only have to sink a micron. If you're 10 microns away from missing, you have to sink 10 microns. So I'm not sure what that length scale should be that you would put in, but it depends by how much you're missing.
Because you know what the timing fraction is. So you can sort of calculate the mean distance between particles.
That's true. I would think the distance that I want to know is kind of the distance, how far away is the center from this boundary? And that could be principle anything.
It's got all scale with your particle size, and you can't get away from that.
Okay.
I don't think. So, your effect, your excluded volume of particles.
I agree with the point that it's not crazy to sink by a meaningful amount in 8 minutes, because that meaningful amount can be quite small. So, just wondering how to calculate that.
Let me sit down with you. Maybe we could cook up a way that might give an answer that makes some sense.
Sure.
Because you know the viscosity of your fluid. Right?
Yep. Okay, so I think this is, so the last slide is just what Michael was bringing up earlier, which is that in the experiments, it does seem to matter where you read out in terms of how strong the signal is, but if you did enough averaging, it's possible that you could read it out at any point in the cycle. So that's the one thing that's still not quite settled in the experiments. But there's enough things that agree with the phenomenology and the simulations that were hopeful, but still it's the little fly in the ointment. Okay, so I mean the last two slides are just meant to be a little bit broader and more provocative, which is to say that maybe these multiple transient memories are some kind of intrinsic method or mode of behavior for far from equilibrium systems. But the question is, what are the ingredients? So can we understand what are the things that you need to put into a system to have these memories? Is there a third system that's not charge density waves and not sheared suspensions where you would have the same class of memories? And
I think how you could do it for sales. I will show a little bit of it.
Oh, great. Wonderful.
Okay. very similar.
Okay. So then the other thing is just to be a little bit provocative, which is that there's a couple of aspects that are shared with biology here. You have cyclic driving, that's very common in biological systems. You also have, like I was claiming before, this is a concrete model for plasticity where you can be learning and forgetting different things in the system over time. And so maybe there's some very broad relationship to biology, although I certainly don't claim that this is a mechanism for this or for that, but it could be a foothold for trying to understand those similarities.
I think there is, because you have a lot of cycles, as you say.
A lot of what, sorry?
A lot of cycles in biological systems, and then you can start playing from outside. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So this is essentially all I wanted to say. So the other thing just to mention is that Sri has looked, and collaborators have looked at, on the face of it, trying to do these same types of memories in amorphous solids, but the difference there, so you still can see these multiple kinks in the mean squared displacement as a function of the applied strain amplitude, where here they've trained at 0.06 and 0.04 over many cycles. But the thing that really looks different in these systems is that you don't have this kind of nesting of memories or nesting of irreversibility. So here I'm fairly reversible at 0.04, but I'm actually less reversible at 0.02, so that there's something different happening kind of midway through the cycle. And so that looks kind of a lot different than the suspensions, while having a lot of other things that are the same on the face of it. So that's really the last thing I wanted to say. And I'll ask Sid to put these things up on the wiki. So, yeah.